And good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, and we're taking our belated holiday break this morning. We'll rebroadcast a program from October in which we explore more dinosaur discoveries with Randall Ermus of the Utah Museum of Natural History. We'll also speak with Brian Hare. He's the director of the Dog Cognition Lab at Duke University. We'll speak to him about his book, The Genius of Dogs. That's all coming up on Cool Science Radio after this word from our underwriters. Stay with us.
This is Michelle from Peak Art and Frame, proud supporters of KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame features local photography and artwork, as well as digital printing, custom framing, and mirrors. Open 7 days a week, rush service available, located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801, peakartandframe.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, making science and technology accessible, amusing, and entertaining. I'm John Wells. I'm here with my co-host, Lynn Ware Peake. And today on the program, we're lucky to be joined by Randall Ermus, New York Times blogger for the Scientist at Work column, who also happens to be curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum of Utah in Salt Lake City.
And good morning, John Wells. And our second guest is New York Times bestselling author Brian Hare. He'll tell us about the genius of dogs, how dogs are smarter than you think. It's all this great science behind some really fascinating elements of a dog's brain.
Two guests plus today's cool story after this. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Egyptian Theater keeps the house rocking with platinum-selling guitarist and Jefferson Starship lead singer and songwriter Craig Chikiso, January 10th and 11th. Grammy-nominated Chikiso is also a chart-topping smooth jazz solo artist named to the top 100 most influential guitarists of all time by Jazz Is magazine, performing music from all genres and eras of his repertoire. Tickets are $39 and up, available at parkcityshows.com or at the box office at 328 Main Street. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at prud-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Good morning and welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Utah is a treasure trove of dinosaur fossils. In the news nearly a dozen times, we've heard about the discovery of new dinosaurs. And our next guest, Randall Ermus, is the curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum. He spends a lot of time in the field in southern Utah and really wherever the correct geology exists to find fossils. He spent time in the Chinle Formation, which contains the dark red and orange conglomerates deposited when the Colorado Plateau was a swampy tropical place. Randall works with huge reptiles and also the small stuff. We'll talk to him about why a small fish fossil is just as important as the discovery of a huge dinosaur like the recent Nosoceratops. I don't think I pronounced that correctly.
I think we said it before when we talked to Scott Sampson, Nosoceratops.
Nosoceratops.
It means big nose.
Big nose. He's also a professor of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. Nice to have you on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here.
And we have a lot of questions for you, but first let me ask you. The museum down in Salt Lake is spectacular. And I wanted to ask you, what is the role of a curator for paleontology at the Natural History Museum?
Well, I get to wear sort of many hats, but one major role is to do research, original research on paleontology. So part of that is going into the field and collecting new fossils to put in the collections of the museum, and then discovering what those fossils mean for understanding ancient ecosystems like the one at the beginning of the Age of Dinosaurs that we're trying to reconstruct that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and 220 million years ago, You have this thing called, I believe you pronounce it, a phytosaur.
That's correct, yeah.
And the phytosaur is long-snouted, heavily armored. I mean, really looks like today's crocodile. What's the difference between today's crocodile and the phytosaur from 220 million years ago?
Yeah, if you met a phytosaur on the street today, it would look almost exactly like an alligator or crocodile. And the only way to really easily tell the difference that it was not a crocodile, and you wouldn't want to get too close because it had lots of sharp teeth, but if you were daring and you got close enough, you'd see that its nose is in between its eyes, whereas in a modern alligator or crocodile, the nose is at the tip of the snout. And that tells us that that these different animals lengthen their snout differently, and they're totally convergent in terms of evolution.
Okay,
so Randy, it's so interesting that you're also a geologist. I mean, I know the two really go hand in hand, but for those of us not into science, you know, we go down to southern Utah and we look at the different layers, and I think many of us wonder, gosh, in what layer do you find dinosaurs? And so I want you to talk a little bit about that, but I want to first ask you where the phytosaur was found, in which layer, and could you have predicted that beforehand?
Yeah, we found the phytosaur in a layer called the Chinle Formation in southern Utah. And this formation, this geologic formation, is exposed throughout the Colorado Plateau and is over 200 million years old. And so similar animals have been found elsewhere in the same formation. So we had an idea that there were fossils there, but these particular exposures that we searched had never really been searched before.
And why is that?
Well, you know, sometimes it's hard to say why exposures never were got to by other people, but A, there's just so much of the Chinle Formation to look at. So it would take thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of hours to really search everything. And then lots of places in Utah are just very remote.
Right.
And as a result, you know, it's hard to get to and find stuff there when you do.
So where was this geographically that you found it? Where specifically in southern Utah?
It's in southern Utah, but I really can't give any more details because this find was on Bureau of Land Management site, and we want to protect the information about where it's found so that nobody goes out and tries to collect the site unauthorized, because to collect vertebrate fossils, that is, fossils of animals with backbones from public land, requires a scientific permit.
Very good. And it's great to say you don't want any of that violated by poachers or goblin tippers.
Well, the positive side of that is that hopefully we'll be able to put the fossils on display once we collect them, and so everybody can come and see them and enjoy them.
Randall, we had Scott Sampson on the show a couple months ago talking about the Nassosoteratops. I pronounced it wrong again.
The big nose guy.
The big horn, big nose, the really ugly dinosaur.
Well, I'm sure its mother loved it.
Yeah.
And I was curious to find that there's only 200 paleontologists in the entire world. As a lot, do you all agree pretty much on everything?
No, we don't agree on everything, but it wouldn't be any fun if everybody agreed on everything. So, I mean, science is all about coming up with hypotheses and continually testing them. And the great part about paleontology is that every new fossil is an additional test of our hypotheses about the ancient world. And, you know, people are finding different stuff. They interpret the fossils differently. And so there's plenty of discussion always going on about what we know and don't know.
For all the hypotheses that you do have for you personally, for the projects that you're working on, what question would you like to see answered?
Well, I'm really interested in the very beginning of the age of dinosaurs, and that's why we're looking in these Chinle Formation rocks, because they preserve that earliest time period. And I really want to know, why did dinosaurs become so successful? During this time in the Triassic period, over 200 million years ago, dinosaurs were just one of many groups of small reptiles. They weren't really that special in any way. And so why did they become so successful over the rest of the Mesozoic for 150 million years, as opposed to some of these other groups. And then we know that this was a time of a hothouse Earth. There were no polar ice caps. At the low latitudes, it was very hot, very dry, and yep, there were distinct climate zones as you move north and south. And so I'm interested to know how those climate zones affected the animals and plants that were living on land at that time.
Which is so great, because that's how you're making a connection from the ancient past to our present right now and our future. Is that what it makes you think of?
Definitely. I mean, that's one of the things dinosaurs can teach us about, is where we might be going in terms of how global climate change will affect the world we live in, because these are times when there was lots of CO2 in the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases, and those times may not be far off for us, depending on what we do.
So, Randy, as a paleontologist and a geologist, then, you know, I know during these different periods, what delineates, I think, the different periods, the Triassic, Jurassic, and the what's the next one? The Cretaceous?
The Cretaceous, yep.
Cretaceous. Are these extinction events, and we know one of those was this huge asteroid, but, you know, as you are in your research, I mean, do you find yourself thinking of, which extinction event is it going to be? I mean, is it going to be climate change, or is it going to be a huge asteroid? What's
well,
your best guess?
It's hard to predict, but I think climate change is a great question, because we know that at the end of the Triassic period, there was a very large extinction event, and it was caused by a really sudden and large pulse of volcanic activity that released lots of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and caused runaway global warming. And that is not too far off as an analog from what we're doing in terms of the amount of greenhouse gases we're putting in the atmosphere and how quickly we're doing it. In fact, we're doing it quicker than any geologic event in Earth's history that we know of.
Really?
And so that does, you know, that does make you think, you know, that we are going to we are having a major impact on the Earth, and but now's the chance for us to change that, and so a lot of people have talked about this quote sixth mass extinction that's happening now because of habitat loss and climate change.
Wow.
Yeah. Can you talk to us about the relationship between chaos and evolution, and how jumps in evolution occur?
Sure. I mean, there's, you know, I don't know too much about chaos theory and stuff like that, but there's, what we know is that people often think about evolution as progressing in this sort of slow, steady, orderly fashion, and that might happen sometimes, but in a lot of cases, you have periods of sort of stability where not a lot of change occurs on sort of geologic timescales, hundreds of thousands to millions of years, and then you have times of stress in some way or lots of change that causes real bursts in evolution happening in very short amount of time. So, for example, we see during the late Triassic period between about 220 and 205 million years ago, we don't see really much change in the types of animals and plants that we find for that, you know, over 10 million year time span. And then right at the end of the Triassic, there's all sorts of change going on in a very short amount of time. And so it seems like evolution occurs a lot in fits and starts.
Randy, I was lucky enough to be present at the Science Friday back in, I think it was March, with Ira Flatow when they were at the Salt Lake Community College, and you were one of the panelists. And wow, it was so great. What amazed me was the number and the complexity of questions that came from audience members, a lot of those children. And there was this one cute little boy who got up and he said, "First of all, can I have two questions?" And one of his questions was about how we, you know, we go to southern Utah and we're in Moab and we don't ever see bones, but we see footprints.
Right.
And you explained about how if bones, you know, surface, then they're very porous.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was you who explained. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about that, because I know we do want to, as tourists, you know, we're kind of interested in maybe finding a dinosaur fossil.
Well, we do find bones, and And people find bones all the time, fossil bones. And they, when they surface, they start to erode right away. And so we often find them as chunks rather than as complete fossils. But we want, you know, as paleontologists, we want people finding fossils too and getting excited by that. But the key thing is, when you find something and it's on public land, report it to a museum or to the bureau, or to the land agency, so that scientists can come out and investigate it and figure out what it is. And that way, you know, any fossils that are collected from public lands, vertebrate fossils, that is, are required to go to a public sort of museum or collection, so that they're held in trust for all of us, so all of us get to enjoy them and have access to them. And so we don't want to discourage people from looking for stuff. It's just, you know, reporting them and getting folks involved.
Right. And then what about the footprints? I mean, we know on, is it the Klondike Bluffs Trail, you can see dinosaur prints.
Mm-hmm.
Are they ubiquitous in southern Utah?
Some geologic layers that we have in southern Utah have lots of dinosaur footprints. And it's particularly those really red and orange rocks that you see in a lot of places in southern Utah. These rocks, for the most part, they're between about 160 and 190 million years old, and they represent ancient sand dunes. And so these ancient sand dunes were really good at preserving footprints of the animals that walked across them. And that's why we find so many dinosaur footprints in the area, because of these right kind of rocks are exposed.
If somebody was to visit the Natural History Museum and go to the paleontology exhibits, take us through what they would find.
Well, our paleontology exhibits are called Past Worlds, and that's no accident, because we're really trying to evoke the past worlds of Utah that are preserved in our geologic record. And so we're sort of divided into different windows into Utah's past. We take the visitor back 15,000 years, when the Great Salt Lake was Lake Bonneville and came right up to the shoreline of and the front steps of the museum. Then we go back about 50 million years ago, when which is still after the time of dinosaurs, but a time when there were crocodiles and conifers above the Arctic Circle, and we had large lakes teeming with fish here in Utah. Then we go back 75 million years ago, talk about southern Utah and some of these amazing dinosaurs coming from Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, like Nasutoceratops that you mentioned. And then finally, take people back 150 million years ago, when all these giant long-necked dinosaurs like Apatosaurus, Diplodocus, Brachiosaurus were living, and Utah state fossil Allosaurus.
Those lakes in southern Utah, they were fed by small streams, but were they fresh water or were they salt water?
Yeah, the lakes that we've had in the geologic past are freshwater, as far as we can tell. They may have, the lakes that exist about 50 million years ago, there's evidence that at some points when the climate got really hot and dry, that those lakes got salty. But the times when the fish were living in them, it looks like they were freshwater.
And were they in the same longitude and latitude where they exist today, or did they come from somewhere else?
They're fairly close. There's a little bit of difference, but not too much. It was just a much warmer time, and as a result, you had these animals, like I mentioned, like crocodiles, living above the Arctic Circle, because the climate was so mild up in the Arctic and Antarctic.
Okay.
Hey, going back to something you mentioned, the Utah state fossil is the Allosaurus.
Mm-hmm.
How many states have a state fossil, and how did the Allosaurus get so lucky to have such fame?
Well, I don't know the exact number of states that have a state fossil, but I do know it's well over half. But not all of the state fossils are as exciting as Allosaurus. And we're lucky because, I mean, we have Allosaurus is this really large meat-eating dinosaur from 150 million years ago, and Utah has the best fossil record of this animal for anywhere in the world. There's a site called the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry south of Price, Utah, and it's a site you can go visit. It's on Bureau of Land Management land, and they have a visitor center, and you can actually see the bones. in the rock as they're found, and we've found over 50 different individuals of Allosaurus from this one site, and thousands of bones that are in the collections of the Natural History Museum of Utah that tell us all about the biology and life and death of the of Allosaurus, and that's why, as such an iconic dinosaur, that's why it became Utah State Fossil.
Great. That's pretty good. I like that. Okay, so wanted to ask you, as you know, you're talking about, for example, the Nezutoceratops being discovered in the Grand Staircase Escalante monument there. You know, it kind of speaks to me about preservation of those lands. And, you know, remember whenever that was, when there was such debate about whether or not that was going to be preserved. I would imagine with all of our extractive practices here, mining and drilling, how vulnerable is the land to, you know, being ruined, having these fossils just ruined forever? Or how much protection is there?
Well, I think there's a real, you know, understanding that we need to protect these fossils by the land agencies, because there are federal laws that actually require that these fossil resources be protected. But certainly with the creation of something like a national monument like we have in Grand Staircase, that gives real added protection. And that monument was created in part because of the science that can be done. And we wouldn't be able to do what we do without those public lands, because they provide an infrastructure for us to be able to go and do that work and figure out what animals, what fossils are there. When permits are applied and approved for things like mining and oil and gas, they are on public land. They are required to survey for fossil resources. But because it's sort of something you have to do before you can do this other resource extraction, you know, you never get as much time or money to do it as you would in a full scale scientific expedition like we do down in Grand Staircase.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Randall Ermus, New York Times blogger for Scientist at Work column, who also happens to be curator of paleontology at the Natural History Museum right here in Salt Lake City. Looking around the world, what are some of the exciting digs that are going on right now and the possibilities?
Well, I'm somewhat biased in the sense that I think we often hear about people finding all these major dinosaur discoveries in exotic locales like Mongolia or Argentina and other places, but I think some of the most exciting discoveries are being made right here in our state in Utah, and that really speaks to the amazing fossil resources we have here. We're finding new dinosaurs in southern Utah all the time, and central Utah as well, and there's really no other state where so many new discoveries are being made at such a pace.
It's not just large dinosaurs. I mean, even these small fossils are just so exciting. I recently had a house built, and the gentleman that built the fireplaces brought the stone down from a Wyoming lake bed that I think was 120 million years old, is what they had chronicled. And I have these fossils. I have a couple of fish fossils, and I have a couple of clam fossils, and I look at them all the time. So it's actually built into the fireplace, and they're very exciting to look at.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I love, actually, in many ways, small fossils are really awesome because you can really get in there and see all the little detail and the amazing preservation, particularly things like fish fossils. And although the big dinosaurs are really get people excited, these small fossils are just as important for understanding all the little links in these ecosystems and all the different creatures that were living there, from the flies to the, you know, to the giant dinosaurs. We want to know about all those different parts of that ancient world.
So, Randy, I guess you must, in your job, it sounds like you have new discoveries all the time, new epiphanies all the time. It's just a very, even though it's so ancient, it's so current.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I love it from the very visceral end of it, where, you know, you're out discovering new fossils, and you're the first person to ever see this fossil, you know, in millions of years. You're absolutely the first person to see it. That's an amazing feeling. And then the feeling from the research side of things in terms of discoveries, what we're finding out, and you know, the pace has just increased. The pace of discovery has increased over the past 20 years immensely, and it's a really vibrant field with all sorts of new discoveries being made, and as we just talked about a few minutes ago, has real relevance for understanding where we're going as well.
Randall, we want to thank you for joining us this morning. It's a fascinating conversation. Randall Ermus, who is the curator for the Natural History Museum in Salt Lake City. We're going to, Lynn and I, for Cool Science Radio, are going to start making some field trips, and we'd love to meet with you sometime down in your museum and talk to you in person.
It's been a real pleasure, and please come and visit anytime.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Randall.
Thanks.
We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me for The Splendid Table, an hour of lively and informative conversation and your calls about the first love in just about everyone's life, food. From in-depth looks at America's food chain to conversations with cheesemakers in the hills of Sicily, food is a doorway to great adventure. So join us. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Join KPCW every Sunday morning at 9 for The Splendid Table, sponsored by River Horse on Main.
The British invasion continues on the Egyptian stage, presented by KPCW. It's Imagine, remembering the Fab Four, December 30th and 31st, Satisfaction, a Rolling Stones experience, January 1st and 2nd, and Queen Nation, January 3rd and 4th. Tickets at parkcityshows.com. More great live entertainment sponsored by KPCW.
KPCW and the Park City Museum present the weekly series Park City History Bits. Learn a nugget of local history. A new bit debuts every week. Park City History Bits, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Only in Park City, only on KPCW. Sponsored by Julie Hopkins of Keller Williams Real Estate.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. This is a rebroadcast program. We're taking a little holiday break today. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. I love talking about dinosaurs. I know nothing about them, but maybe that's why it makes it so interesting. So I want to thank Randall or Randy Ermus. Did you know that your dog can make inferences about you and evaluate your intelligence? It's true. You may have suspected it, but now actually science proves that, along with many other elements about the genius of dogs. And our next guest, Brian Hare, is the founder of Duke University's Dog Cognition Lab. I think it's so wild what they have at universities, a dog cognition lab. He's also a leader in the surging field of dog cognition. Now, in a massive compilation of scientific study and in a very readable and fun text, Brian Hare and Vanessa Woods take us through just how the mind of man's best friend works. It's called The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. And Brian Hare, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
All right. Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. And I love this book because I'm a huge dog person. And but maybe I shouldn't even begin with that. It's a great book. And I want to just start off with the type of research that you did. I think at one point you say you refer to like 600 different articles. So if there wasn't science behind it, you did not include it in your book.
Yay, that's correct. So I'm saying yay because very few people ask me that question, and that's absolutely right. What's really different about this book, there are lots of dog books out there that are great, but what's different is that we didn't say anything that wasn't in the peer-reviewed published scientific literature. So that means we didn't even cite or use popular books where people have written books for the popular audience, because a lot of those books, they're based on expertise but not on the scientific literature.
Right. And because we're so attached to dogs, I think we love to hear those anecdotal stories, and we probably create them and make them up ourselves. But this is really about finding out the genius of dogs. And let's go into the genius a little bit. You start your book off by talking about different types of genius. Obviously, dogs can't take an IQ test.
No. And in fact, I wish we didn't have to take IQ tests. Because when you start studying cognition and you recognize what cognition is, you realize there's lots of different types of intelligence. So everybody has this understanding intuitively, but in some sense, because we have to take IQ tests, it's beaten out of us. So everybody knows some people are really good at math, and some people are really good at English, and some people are really good at science and history. And, you know, just because you're good at one doesn't mean you're good at the other. And it's the exact same thing when we're talking about animal psychology. You can have an individual or a species that has an amazing ability to communicate, but it has a horrible memory, or one that is amazing in terms of their ability to reason, but then doesn't have much empathy, or vice versa. And so, you know, you can very easily get obsessed about, oh, what animal is smarter, or is my dog smart or not? But what we try to convey in the book is really the real question is not is it that dogs are smart, but what makes them smart? What is the strategy they use that is their unique genius? And so that's what you know, we concentrate on.
And Brian, Park City is a huge dog town. We have twice as many dog parks than we have liquor stores. And and the Home Depot in Park City is one of two in the world that allows dogs. So it's just a huge dog town. And I wanted to ask you.
I love Park City, so you know, I know what you're talking about.
Great. What are some of the most commonly held myths about dogs?
Well, I think that you know, touching on the idea that, you know, oh, my dog is smart or my dog is dumb. I mean, that's a myth already right there. It's a myth in that it's the wrong way to think about intelligence. The question isn't, is your dog smart or dumb? The question is, what is it that your dog uses? What are the strategies? Is your dog amazing as a communicator? Is it a dog that relies on its memory? Is it incredibly empathic? That would be one right there, is if you are taking care of your dog and you love your dog as much as you probably do, I promise you your dog is a genius. The question is, how are they doing it? And there are different strategies that dogs use. And I would say another myth is the idea that because dogs are so closely related to wolves, that they actually have the exact same social system and that they treat each other, the dogs treat each other, the same way that wolves treat each other, and that's just not true. It ends up, for instance, while wolves have a very strict hierarchy, there are individuals who are alpha to everyone else, and they suppress the behaviors of others, et cetera, and it makes sense in their social context. That is not what dogs do when left to their own devices. When you leave dogs feral and they don't have human interference, they actually don't have a very strict hierarchy. And in fact, the leader in a dog pack is the individual that has the most friends or the most affiliative relationships. So these are the types of things that when you start looking into the scientific literature, it really challenges your ideas about our relationship with our dogs.
I was also surprised to read how observant dogs are. So dogs will be in a social setting, and as you write in the book about dogs observing if a person is kind to another person, if a person allows another dog to win a tug of war, and they capture this information and they use it later.
Well, yeah, and I mean, the fun thing is that, you know, you may or may not think that already, but that's where science is great, is that, you know, people have actually tested this in a very rigorous way. To look, if dogs observe two other people interacting and they see that somebody's not very nice and somebody's really nice, they actually prefer the nice person, and they haven't even interacted with either of them. Both of those people are strangers. So, you know, it really helps reveal what dogs do and what they don't do. And I think one of the big take-home messages from the book in total is the genius of dogs is really all about their social abilities. And in many cases, they struggle when they're on their own and when they have to solve problems by themselves. But as soon as they can watch somebody else solve a problem, whether it's a human or potentially even another dog, they absolutely are genius and very quickly can solve problems that in many cases other species can't solve.
Mm. So, Brian, as dogs have evolved away from, you know, running in packs and, you know, operating more in a hierarchy like wolves, what are they losing and what are we not providing them as we, you know, as they become domesticated and we have them oftentimes just on their own without another dog present?
Well, that's really fun. So, you know, when we want, just again, to repeat what I said, so feral dogs actually don't have a dominance hierarchy. And they do not have an alpha. And they do not have a social structure like wolves. So what does that mean then when dogs are in our own homes? Well, people have done preference tests where they have looked at when you give dogs the choice between being with other dogs or people, what do they choose? Well, they actually much prefer to be with people than other dogs. Mm-hmm. And again, that's very different than wolves. When you give wolves that exact same choice, even if they've been raised by people, wolves prefer to be with wolves and not with people. So dogs have really evolved to want to be with people more than anything else. So your dog by itself at home, it's if it's sad, it's not sad because it's lonely for not having another dog. It's lonely because it wants to be with people.
Right. So do dogs learn more quickly from humans than they do from members of their own species, or does it depend?
It definitely depends. It depends on the context. There's some cases where dogs actually learn a little bit faster from dogs. But when talking about visual gestures, when you're talking about problems that they can't solve on their own, so if you have a problem, for instance, where very simple thing, where you just put food down in a bowl, or sorry, in a Tupperware container, a dog can knock the top off the Tupperware container, as everybody knows, and get the food out. But when you lock the container, you clip it shut, so now there's no way the dog can open it. Well, this is where dogs, again, are very remarkable. So if you give a wolf that problem, the wolf just keeps beating and beating and beating on the box and trying to chew through and find some way to open that box. Even a chimpanzee will do something very similar. They're determined to find the solution on their own, which in many contexts isn't a bad thing. But what dogs do that's very different is as soon as they figure out they can't open that box, they turn around and look at their human that's closest and say, "Hey, you, come here. I know you can help me with this."
Brian, can you talk to us about the new theory in your book that dogs domesticated us rather than the other way around?
Yeah. I mean, the idea is, first of all, that dogs are self-domesticated. So it's not that man created dog. Wolves were attracted to humans as we began to settle around 12,000 years ago. And they basically took advantage of new resources provided by the fact that there was a lot of garbage. And friendly wolves evolved into dogs. We know from experiments when you select for friendliness, you get curly tails and floppy ears and piebald coats. So it's not hard to imagine that wolves were attracted to human settlements. The idea that hunter-gatherers who are living at this same period would want a wolf in their camp while they're off foraging to leave a wolf with their child and to bring food home to take care of the wolf, that just seems untenable. It's definitely that wolves chose humans and, you know, were selected for friendliness. In terms of humans, though, what was the impact on humans? Well, it's not that hard to imagine that once you have proto-dogs that are actually helping in a variety of ways, whether it's warning when people, strangers, are coming close, maybe even occasionally helping on a hunt. But the other thing they do is, and it's a little bit uncomfortable to think about, but when you're in a moment of hardship, you know, these proto-dogs could have been a very easy way to deal with, you know, when you don't have food. And then it's not a big leap to then think, hey, we should not just have dogs as our sort of storage, but what about plants? And it's very easy to think that maybe dogs help people think about agriculture.
Very interesting. Well, I like to think that my dog chose me. That supports the whole symbiotic nature of our relationship with dogs, and maybe why a dog is man's best friend. You know, no other animal really is called that, right?
That's right. And, you know, I think it's hard for people, it's hard to imagine that we didn't create dogs, because when you look at all the different breeds, it's obvious that humans used artificial selection to create all these different breeds. Now, that is absolutely true. But the hidden fact is that happened about 200 years ago. But dogs are 15,000 years old. So what happened for 15,000 years?
Yeah.
And the answer is, I think wolves chose us. Not that humans intentionally created dogs.
Okay. So speak about loyalty a little bit, because that ties in. You know, there are some dogs that are so darn loyal, and it seems not like something that we've taught them, but maybe you would say it is something we've taught them.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, we didn't really, that's one of those places where we didn't go in the book, because, you know, how would you test for loyalty? It's not that this is where I get to be a person instead of a scientist. So I take my science hat off. And I'd say, you know, as a person, absolutely, dogs are totally loyal. I mean, my best friend growing up was a dog, so I totally know what you're talking about. But then I put my science hat back on, and anytime you have science, you have to be able to falsify something. You have to be able to show it's not true. Well, how in the world would you falsify that a dog is loyal? And how would you compare two different dogs and show that one is more loyal than the other?
Right. Okay.
You know, I always thought that Lassie, would, you know, found Gramps and was loyal to Gramps, but that was a TV show, right?
Exactly. So I'm not saying dogs aren't loyal. It's just, you know, I don't know that anybody's tried to tackle that question scientifically yet. I think it's a great one, and that's one of the points we make in the book, is that, you know, the book is about what has been scientifically approachable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that all the interesting questions have been approached, though, and I think it's a fantastically cool question, and I hope somebody will figure out how to do it.
Brian, what one question would you like to see answered that you haven't been able to get your arms around yet?
Well, we're working really hard to look at individual differences. You know, a lot of people want to know about breed differences. Why is it that one breed of dog might be different than the other? And first of all, we review the science on breed differences, and there's not much evidence for all the breed differences we intuitively feel like might be there. And so, therefore, you have to set up hypotheses. And one hypothesis is, as we believe, breeds are really different. There's going to be lots of psychological differences that are related to what these animals were bred for. The alternative hypothesis is that actually there are not many breed differences. There's so much variance within a breed. Individual dogs that are Labradors are so different from one another that actually those differences are bigger than the differences you see between the different breeds. Hmm. And that may be the result of the fact that for the last 50 years, people have been breeding dogs not as much based on their function, but more on their form. And so it may be some of the things that originally dogs were bred for, that it hasn't been the pressure anymore. And so their psychology is sort of all over the place, and breed predicts very little. So the reason I say that we've been working on this and it's a fun thing to think about for the future is it's a really hard thing to test. There are hundreds of breeds. You need thousands and thousands of dogs to be able to look at this. Here at Duke, we can really only test a few hundred a year, so you can see how big this problem is. And that's why we created Dognition.com. I don't know if you all heard of it, but it's an online a resource for people to actually play some of the same cognitive games we talk about in the book. And you can find out about your dog and how it thinks, but then it's also contributing to this larger citizen science endeavor to understand things like breed differences.
If you are just joining us, we're having a conversation with Brian Hare, who's the founder of Duke University's Dog Cognition Lab. He and his wife, Vanessa Woods, have written a fascinating book, The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. So, Brian, tell us about these tools that you have in, and I'll just repeat this, Dognition.com, for dog users to be able to go and evaluate the intelligence of their own dogs.
Yeah, so Dognition is really sort of a celebration of the individual dog. So if the book is about all dogs and what we've learned about the species, Dognition is the next natural step, which is, given we know this about all dogs, can we then use those games, first of all, to learn about our individual dogs at home? I've played these games with my dog, and I've gotten the big, long Dognition report on what it all means about my dog. And it's super fun because you play games that measure your dog's empathy, communication, memory, inference, their skills at being cunning. You look at all these things, and the report tells you how your dog compares to all the other dogs in our database, thousands of dogs. And so you find out that, well, you know, in my case, I thought my dog was an amazing communicator, but actually relative to all the other dogs in the database, yeah, he's kind of average there. But where he was really remarkable was he's incredibly empathic in a way that I didn't know. Yeah. I didn't know relative to other dogs that what he was doing was kind of unusual. I would never have predicted that. And so I learned something about my best friend, and you know, I know him better. In fact, the most extreme way to think about it is I had somebody living in my house I didn't even know. So that's the first part of the project. But the second part is, because you learn about your dog, you at the same time contribute the data that you've collected to the citizen science endeavor, which we make discoveries and then share them with everybody else about all dogs. And one of the things that you can do right now, it's totally free to the public, is you can go, there's a link on our website that says explore the data. Our entire data set is free and available online, and you can query it. You can ask questions like, is it that purebred dogs are different than mixed breed dogs? Is it that males and females think differently than one another? Is it that dogs that are spayed or neutered or young or old? All these types of questions, the data is there for you to play with, and you can ask questions and actually see what thousands of dogs have done. It'll instantly compare all these different groups for you, and you can see what real dogs have done on games that we think are important to measure psychology.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. It sounds like a really good way to spend a lot of time. Which I'm sure, you know, people love to learn more about their dogs. And before we let you go here, Brian, I just have to ask you one more question. I don't know if it's entirely fair to ask you as a scientist, but we have a couple very popular dog whisperers around this area.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? I mean, are these just people who have learned so much about dogs that they can look at the empathy of your own dog? And I mean, what do you think, or do you have an opinion on dog whisperers?
Well, it's always case by case, but, you know, I work with lots of different species. I also work in Africa, and I work with bonobos and chimpanzees and orphanages where they've been rescued from the bushmeat trade. The reason I bring that up in this context is in each case, in the places where I work in Africa, there's an individual, a really compassionate, empathic person who has risked so much to save these animals. And so do they have a special gift, something that's really different about them that allows them, to do at great sacrifice to themselves an amazing thing that most of us wouldn't do? I think so. So, are they animal people? You bet. So then take it back to the dog whisperer. Yeah, I mean, there are experts who are not scientists who I learn things from all the time. They have observed things that I would never have observed and I wouldn't even believe was possible. But as a scientist, then my job is, okay, if that is really your observation, we need to then challenge that idea. We need to think about how could we falsify it? Because if it's true, we won't be able to falsify it. So take case in point, the most famous dog whisperer, Cesar Millan, has argued that being alpha over your dog is really important to train them. And it just ends up, that doesn't hold up to scientific scrutiny when you look at the social system of wolves and compare them to dogs. There's just not a grain of evidence that dogs have to be dominated in order to be well-adjusted and happy and trainable. In fact, it's quite the opposite. When you look at their social system, they have very little hierarchy, and the leader of the pack, again, is the most affable, most connected, friendliest animal in the group. So, I absolutely think people can have a special touch, a special way with animals, but that doesn't then make them immune to scientific inquiry.
Mm-hmm. Great answer. That's really interesting. Wonderful. Well, Brian Hare, it's been a pleasure talking with you. The book is The Genius of Dogs, How Dogs Are Smarter Than You Think. Brian Hare, our guest, co-wrote it with his wife, Vanessa Woods. It's on the New York Times bestseller list. Brian, thanks so much for your time today.
Hey, it was really fun.
And that, again, was Brian Hare, and the book is The Genius of Dogs.
Good guy.
Great guy. And really good science and such interesting stuff. I love it. I've looked at Jack in a different way.
Jack's a cool dog. And
he has high genius. Well, we want to thank our guest, Randy Ermus, curator of the paleontology department at the Utah Museum of History, Natural History Museum of Utah. There we go. I knew I'd get it. And also Brian Hare about the genius of dogs.
Yeah.
Okay, today's cool story.
Yeah.
Now, a couple weeks ago, we spoke with Wired magazine editor and New York Times magazine contributor Clive Thompson about his new book called Smarter Than You Think. And it turns out we talked with Clive because he was one of the testers for the Google Glass,
yeah,
which is so fascinating.
Right now, yeah, it's in beta test mode.
Right. He was a tester. He talked about it. He talked about how it's not distracting when you're driving. But guess what?
Yeah.
Somebody already got ticketed.
We knew it was going to happen. It finally happened.
In San Diego, this gal, Cecilia ought to be. So she must be a tester for it. Okay, granted, she got pulled over for speeding. But upon getting pulled over, apparently she didn't hide the goods. And she didn't take the Google Glass off or something. She ends up also getting ticketed. And the officer must have thought, wow, this is my lucky day. For the first time in history, I am ticketing someone for wearing Google Glasses. And it's just because it's a monitor that's visible to you as a driver.
Exactly.
What do you think about that?
You know, we were talking during the break, and, you know, in Boston and your experience in Europe, I mean, people drive differently than they do in Park City. That was the biggest adjustment I had to make when I moved here, was that everyone's so chilled. So I think in Park City, you can wear Google Glass, you can prepare tonight's dinner, you can play, you know, play your violin, you can do anything you want while you're driving, because there's, you know, you're just kind of cruising along at the speed limit. But in some of these other places, I don't know, all this technology that we're introducing inside the car.
Right, right. I mean, I really noticed that in Europe, because you're not allowed to use any technology. You get arrested for it. Driving takes so much more concentration there. And here, as you notice, people don't concentrate when they drive, because if they did, they wouldn't hang out in the fast lane going 55 miles an hour on their way to Salt Lake. I went the other day, and I swear I passed, every single person I passed was someone in the fast lane.
It's so relaxed. It's so chilled. And my buddy Robbie used to tell me all the time when I first moved here, he said, you know, you got to slow down. You got to relax. But, you know, right on red, left on red, straight through red. I mean, that's driving to me.
That's real driving. So this Google Glass, one of the things that Clive Thompson said is when you're wearing it, you can also, you know, have your GPS activated and it's telling you at the same time which way to turn. So he found it actually less distracting because it's right there within your field of vision, yet it doesn't block your field of vision. So it's not like, you know, you have to look down at your phone or you're on dash GPS. So he felt it was actually less distracting, which I was going, I bought that. Although he stopped short of saying, he said, when you ride your bicycle, he doesn't want to do it then.
Well, that's an application that makes sense. But when someone's texting you back and forth, or you're trying to respond to a complex email and your hands are moving and everything else, I'm not sure. It's a little different GPS, but I certainly understand that application.
That's right. Well, interesting. And good luck to Cecilia Adabi, who got busted for wearing Google Glasses. I want to thank our underwriters today, Prudential Utah Real Estate and San Francisco Design. And let's go to this quick underwriting break. We'll be back. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Thanks for tuning in today.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information. Contrary to popular belief, getting pregnant can be difficult. For some couples, it can be quite a challenge. The OBGYNs at Park City Specialty Clinic are there to help you find solutions for pregnancy on your terms. The appointment number is 435-658-7400. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com, VaultHomeLoans.com, Purchase and Refinance Mortgages, Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to this rebroadcast program of Cool Science Radio, taking a little early 2014 break here. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My co-host John Wells is off on assignment somewhere, hopefully sleeping in. Also want to thank our underwriter Peak Art and Frame. Thanks to all of our underwriters, without whom this show would not be possible. And just taking a quick look at weather before we head into National Public Radio News' morning edition. It's 28 degrees in Old Town Park City. Looking for some possible patchy fog into tonight, but otherwise today sunny and beautiful. 43 degrees the high. Tomorrow will be a little bit chillier and a chance of rain or snow, 50 to 60% on Friday. So we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. And tomorrow's high, 39 degrees. Saturday's high, just 22 degrees. So a little chillier heading into the weekend. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Good morning.